Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning and welcome to First Coast Connect. I'm Dan Scanlon, sitting in this week for Ann Schindler. Today, from fighting literal fires to putting out political ones, we'll talk to the head of Jacksonville Fire and Rescue Department about the job of running the city's emergency services. Later in the program, a millionaire's bachelor pad is the launching pad for a story about architecture and murder. But first, from reviving pensions to securing firefighter pay raises, Jacksonville's fire rescue chief has had a banner year, and I've been lucky enough to cover a lot of that as a reporter here at WJCT, but his 2 decades with the agency have not been completely stress-free. To discuss that, we're joined now by JFRD Chief Keith Powers. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Dan. How are you?
I'm wonderful for a Monday. Now, I've known you probably for a good 10 years as a reporter, as you've risen up in the front ranks. We've certainly covered some storms together. You weren't in the front during some of the wildfires of the 80s and 90s, but I know you were out there. So let's just talk about you, first of all, and the guy that you were when you had hair, maybe. You began fire service with Nassau County Fire Rescue in the 1990s, and just take it from there. I mean, here you are working in Yulee, battling, pine fires or whatever.
Yeah, I was not going to be a fireman. My wife's dad was a firefighter for Jacksonville for 32 years, and she was not going to be married to a fireman. And it just so happened, a friend of mine in Briceville that is a contractor out there, but he was a volunteer firefighter, and he asked me to go to a volunteer firefighter meeting in Briceville with him, and that's how it all started. And I just fell in love with it and come home one day and told Robin, I think I'm fixing to go to fire school. And that didn't go over well to start with, but I went to fire school and got hired in Nassau County and served a couple years up there. And then in 1996, got my dream job to come to work for JFRD.
Now, I made the comment about when you had hair. I've been meaning to ask this officially for years. I know the reason. Lots of folks know it. But why do so many firefighters who I know, including someone in my neighborhood, have adopted the hairless attitude? It can't be stress.
So what really happens is our masks that we wear in fires, they're made of rubber. And where it goes over the head, they used to, when you pulled them tight, it would wind your hair up in there in the rubber, and then you couldn't get it out. So when you went to take the mask off, you just kind of had to pull it off, and hair came out with it. So that's why I cut mine, plus the fact that I'm follically challenged in certain spots on my head. So it just kind of became easier and easier for it to get shaved closer and closer. And
well, remember that, folks out there, you heard it here first on First Coast Connect as to why some, not all firefighters have gone follically challenged with the assistance of a razor blade. Now, you come into Jacksonville between 1999 and 2006. You rise through the ranks from engineer all the way up to captain in charge of fire stations on the west side. So when did the thought, maybe I can take this one to the top, maybe I can work hard and I can learn stuff and be a leader of all versus some?
Never.
Never.
It never did. Never had a desire. In fact, when I came on at Fire Station 17, which over in Woodstock Park, the engineer that was over there at the time, we used to talk about it. And all I wanted to do was be able to promote to the rank of engineer so I could retire with some dignity. I didn't have to come in at the lowest rank and never make any rank at all. And I made engineer in 99 and 2003, made lieutenant in 2006, made captain. And that was kind of where I wanted to get, was to captain, because that's where, you know, you're still in the fire station, you're still out there on the streets, but you're at the top of that level. And just so happened that Chief Kurt Wilson, who used to be the fire chief, was the chief of operations at the time, and he approached me about going to run our tactical support division, which is what maintains all of our apparatus. I had a background in that before I got on the fire department with WW Gay, and after some back and two, I ended up over there, and things just started happening that I did not plan or desire. It just happened. And when he became the fire chief, he asked me to come be his chief of operations. And after he retired from becoming the fire chief, Mayor Lenny Curry asked me to come be the chief of the department, but it was never anything planned.
And that's 2019. And now here you have the honor of being a fire chief with two administrations. You say that's a first?
So Captain Nick Tyson is one of our department historians. He informed me the other day, I wasn't aware of it, that I'm the first fire chief since consolidation that's ever made the transition between administrations.
Now, I have been here for 40 years covering things. Chances are we've been in the same vicinity a lot of times. I've watched the fire chiefs. I've watched the top chiefs, the captains, everyone doing a fire, just like on TV. There they are with the radio. There's the fire. I mean, just watch your step, all the hoses. What are some of the memorable fires or incidents that you have handled yourself in any capacity?
Probably the most memorable one I have is a fire on Beaver Street between Edgewood and Ellis Road. It was called the Tire Man, and it was a building that was almost a city block long. And I was the rank of firefighter working for a captain named Lloyd Ray, who was my first officer. And he believed in playing musical chairs. He didn't believe that you sat in the same seat every day. And so one day he would drive and I would ride in charge and the engineer would ride in the back, and we just moved around. He wanted everybody to know everybody's job. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was a November night, cold, rainy, cold front coming in. And I would happen to be riding in the in charge seat. And we went to this this fire that ended up, today would be a fifth alarm. At that time, it was a second alarm. But I did such a great job, I burned a whole city block down. But seriously, it had used tires in it. There wasn't a lot we could do.
Well, people have to realize that a tire fire can molder forever, because it's just, that's the material that it is.
Yeah, but the heat is so intense. The BTUs that are put off by those tires are so intense that there's nothing you can do about it. But that was my first big fire riding in charge, and I'll never forget that. I learned a lot at that fire. I remember I tried to give the radio back to Captain Ray and let me catch the hydrant because we laid out going in, and he was like, I'm not here. You're in charge. And that's how he taught us how to be and how to do. And I learned a lot of lessons from him.
What about things that you yourself have had hands on with? I have, over my 40 years, been to some scenes, and as a TV cameraman, once my light was necessary some nights for some incidents, I'd they'd say, we need your light, just don't shoot it. Okay, fine, no problem. And your heart breaks. What about, did you have any of those? Because I certainly have memories of a lot of heartbreaking episodes. As a reporter, I can't react to them, but I still think about them.
Yeah, probably losing firefighters is probably the toughest thing scenes I've been to. When we lost the two firefighters at sea, and had right after I became fire chief, and we had a week long search for those, that was pretty tough. Dealing with Stephanie McClooney and her family, with that loss. One of the things that I remember greatly about that was how the community rallied around the Jacksonville Fire and Rescue Department to try to help us in that time, not only helping us look offshore, but bringing food and water to the scene where we were running our command post. That meant a lot inside, but it was very difficult dealing with, understanding the loss that was coming for Stephanie and her family and the family out of Virginia.
I remember that very well. I remember the toughest for me was the child, in a car crash, a child in a fire, where a grandmother couldn't get out, 2 years ago, because she had bars on her window, and the neighbor let us look into that room, and there's a book, a child's book, sitting on the windowsill, and there were children inside. And then that became a launching point for another free fire alarm program and more.
Yeah, when I was at 17 in Woodstock, I went to a fire one time where a grandmother with three children actually found her at the front door, burglar bars, and she had the three kids in her arms and the key in her hand trying to get out of the burglar bars. Those are tough scenes. You don't forget them. Just to see that tragic loss of life is absolutely heartbreaking.
And at least, as I've known with you and Captain Proswimmer, who's your PIO, those are launching points for education for the public. You go out, we don't realize that there is a fire alarm program. The folks at Firehouse Subs also have done that with the money they raise. You use that to tell people in the cold weather, don't sleep near a kerosene heater, electric heater. In the hot weather, watch your wiring. And yet we still have fires caused accidentally by cooking and things like that. So it doesn't matter what season, at least you guys are using it, I've noticed, as a launching point for education.
Yeah, we have a fire safety community advocate that goes out anytime we have a a fire that somebody's critically injured in or that's killed in, we go into that neighborhood and intensely saturate that neighborhood, passing out smoke detectors, passing out fire safety information to try to just get the information out. And hopefully that will prevent somebody else from, you know, a loss of life in the future.
Now, in case you're just joining us, we are talking about Jacksonville's Fire and Rescue Department with Chief Keith Powers. And we want you to join the conversation live on air by calling us at 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. Now, the one thing that I've noticed in my past few years is the amount of ribbon cuttings and golden shovels that I've been to. Apparently, during Mayor Curry's administration, there was a major push, which is still going on today, in fact, one right outside our door here, to get more fire stations. So you've been around. What's the genesis? I mean, it seems to me we have fire stations everywhere we need them. Duh, maybe not. You tell me.
So we have a lot of fire stations in the city, but because of the ISO rating that we currently enjoy as an ISO class one, that requires us to continually grow as a department. But in addition, if you don't live within 5 road miles of a fire station, then you don't enjoy those ISO class one insurance savings. And so we're trying to put fire stations in areas where that are not within 5 road miles. And then some areas, our Hogan Road Station, for example, that area, 51, which is off Old St. Augustine Road, and the whole northwest quadrant is just so busy right now that we need to put in what we call pocket stations. And that's just to relieve the amount of runs that are happening in that area to ensure that we can respond in the appropriate amount of time to save your life should something happen. So because the city's growing so much, fire rescue has to grow with that.
I mean, I can think of a number of occasions. For example, E-Town obviously used to be just sand dunes and pine forest. You've got a fire station there now along that 9B extension where there's tons of traffic. You have a fire station near the IKEA there on Gate Parkway, and you had a 3-alarm apartment fire when the complex was being built. And if that doesn't put a punctuation mark on, hey, we need a station here, then just drive that area or go to the burger place nearby on a Friday night and watch the amount of traffic there to realize that station is needed. And you do something which I didn't realize. You put a double wide in and a shed and then start building next door so that the station gets there earlier than the capital construction time period.
Yeah. And we're doing that currently right now with Fire Station 76 out on the north side off New Berlin Road. We put the double wide trailer and a shed there to put the apparatus in. And we're fixing to start building the real hard facility, but that takes time. And if we wait on that to happen, it could be years down the road before we actually get fire and rescue services in that area. So we go ahead and put a temporary station in place and then start working on the capital station itself.
Would you say this is a record-breaking period of establishing or building fire protection in the city? Maybe not since the 40s or 50s has something like this occurred?
I think it is the record. I tell people we are living in the golden age of fire and rescue right now, not only with the growth of fire stations, but the growth of personnel within the department and apparatus. This is the golden age of the fire rescue industry in Jacksonville.
And it's not just men and women riding fire engines, cross-trained to be paramedics. You have instituted some much more a trauma medicine oriented. What's the name of the new units that actually are carrying some serious drugs and plasma and blood products?
So every unit, every fire engine, ladder, marine boat, rescue unit in the city is advanced life support. We're the all largest advanced life support department in the country. But we just recently started a program called Critical Care Paramedic Rescue Units, which even up that level of care even higher, talking about the blood products and stuff that you just mentioned, to help ensure that when we show up, we basically have a role in emergency room showing up at your house to help you if you're having a medical emergency.
And that, I mean, what's the difference between that and the rescue unit that rolls up with a fire engine?
Just the level of care is higher. You know, JFRD has been at the forefront of a lot, leading at a lot of things in the fire and rescue industry. You know, we started rescue right here in Jacksonville in 1967. Now every fire station you go to in the country has got a rescue unit or an ambulance sitting in there, but that started right here. In 1977, HAZMAT in the fire service started here. It was nowhere else in the world. It started here. We had people flying in from all over the world to see how Jacksonville was doing that. Now every fire and rescue department in the country has a hazmat team. Just our emergency preparedness division that falls under fire rescue. It's the first accredited EOC in the country. And I could go on and on with these first. And again, this critical care paramedic rescue unit concept was just another one of those things we wanted to be the first at and start setting the standard or the bar higher. The intent, I won't see it in my career, but the intent is to have every rescue unit in this city be critical care paramedic rescue unit certified. But the problem is that it takes time. Is you have to be, we require that you be nationally certified to be on those units. And that takes a lot more training and a lot more time getting prepared for those tests. So we're gradually working through that process, but hopefully in 4 or 5 years down the road, that's where we'll be.
Now, what about what's coming? I mean, obviously we are sitting at WJCC Studios and you are building, as we speak, a brand new Marine fire station right outside. They're putting the pilings in and that's going to move the old Marine unit from what used to be at what Metro Park mm-hmm. and the kids campus. Now it's somewhere else, moves it here and it's right next to a bridge that has issues. So when are we seeing that? And you did mention you're running into something right now in trying to get it built.
Yeah. So, we're working on the dock portion of it right now. That'll be that's phase one. And, they're obviously are running into, as they drive those piles, they're running into some debris as they're driving those piles and they're having to try to figure out some solutions to that right now. That's why we don't hear them out there pile driving today. But very shortly, phase one of that dock will be finished and we'll start the construction of the actual physical fire station right behind that. But we have fire stations under construction throughout the city right now. New Fire Station 22 is going to open up on July 29th. Over off of Lane Avenue.
Oh, I know he'll send a news release.
And Lennox Avenue. Yeah, we'll be sending that very shortly to you. We have Fire Station 76, which I mentioned earlier, has a temporary station now, but that is the hard station is in the design phase right now. We'll probably be starting construction in the next 6 or 8 months on that station. We've asked for Fire Station 66 in the upcoming budget, CIP. The mayor will be presenting that on the 15th of this month. We'll see if we're getting that, but that's Merrill and 295. These are all in the CIP 5-year plan. Fire Station 67 is currently in that plan as well for Sherwood Forest. That area has a lot of runs, and we need to get some help in there for them to reduce response times. And Fire Station 77 is in the CIP as well, and that's planned, and that's out way out on the west side, west of 301. Between the Trail Ridge Landfill and I-10 and all the way to the Baker County line.
That's literally past Maxville. That's as far as you can go.
Yeah, there's a development coming out there that is going to be as big or bigger than Nocatee. And so we've already got land designated out there inside of this area, this new area that's going to be constructed out there, and got the fire station plan. The plan for that fire station is to have an engine, a ladder, a rescue, a chief, a tanker. Is going to be a big fire station, but because it's so far out and isolated like that, it needs all of that equipment to be able to respond to that area with the growth that's coming.
Guys, we would love to hear you some calls here. Give us a yell at 904-549-2937. And we've got Kevin from Jacksonville has a comment. So let's go to Kevin. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. I live in the Nocatee in the Duval section of Nocatee. We're served by, I believe it's Station 62 across from the Avenue Mall. And I'd like you to comment a little bit on mutual aid compacts because that station's about 15 minutes from me. And St. John's responds on many occasions when there's emergencies. I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Thank you. That's right. I was just about to ask the question, if you live on one of the county lines, you have mutual aid with other departments in other counties, and many's the time I've gone to fires, and there's two, even three different counties. So where did that develop? Is it because we've started growing so much in the borders, you can't tell where one county line stops and another begins?
That's really what's happened in Nocatee. You know, part of Nocatee is in Duval County, part of it's in St. John's County. But there's two things that we have. We have mutual aid agreements with all the surrounding counties, but we also have auto aid agreements with some of the surrounding counties as well. And Nocatee is a prime example of that, where the fire station that's in Nocatee that belongs to St. John's County, we have our dispatch stuff in their fire station. So when our units, our closest units, gets dispatched to a run inside of Nocatee, so does the St. Johns County Fire Station, and they respond because they can get there quicker than we can. And that ensures that the citizens that are living within Duval County get you know, great fire protection as well and great EMS service. Those auto aid agreements are also critical in ensuring that our ISO rating for those folks stays low as well, so your insurance rates are not as high as they would be if we didn't have them.
And that's the reason for the pocket stations. You use that phrase, but let me explain better. A pocket station is to put a smaller station in between two existing stations because the growth and the number of runs are getting so bad for the existing ones that they need some help in between, right?
Yeah, the run numbers are just so high that we have to get them in there. We have some stations that are running in excess of, 700, 800, 900 runs a month, just one station. Station 1 downtown is a prime example of that. You know, they're running 700, 800, 900 runs a month, and it just becomes to the point that now they're so busy that the companies that are around them have to come in, and then the companies that are around those have to come in and backfill for those because the run numbers are so high, so we have to put pocket stations in place. In fact, one of the things that we're looking at in future planning is where are we going to put another downtown fire station? Because with the growth coming downtown, we've got, and the run numbers at the level they are, we're going to have to put some pocket stations in the downtown area.
And, you know, a year ago, that would have been a nice academic question. And then the Rise Doro, 98% complete, wood frame underneath, becomes a multi-alarm blaze that keeps on smoldering. Your thoughts about that and maybe the tragedy of seeing something so close to a helping a renaissance of this neck of the woods become what it is now, concrete core, soon to re-begin?
Yeah, it was tragic, and it was almost heartbreaking, you know, because, you know, Mayor Curry, when he was the mayor, he planted some seeds. Mayor Deegan has continued to plant those seeds down. I tell people all the time, downtown in 5 years, because of the work of these two mayors, is not going to look the same. It's not going to, you wouldn't recognize, if you left and came back 5 years later, you're not going to recognize this landscape. And that was, the Doro was one of those. And to see it, you know, when I got that call late that night that it was burning and what was going on with it, it was just, you know, it was heartbreaking because it was so close to completion. But the men and women of JFRD just did an amazing job for almost a week down there under some pretty difficult circumstances.
Yeah, you guys sent us the audio of some of the radio transmissions, and there are multiple times, and that leads to our caller coming up here in a second, multiple transmissions to get your tail out of there because there's fire above you, there's fire below you, and get out and we'll attack this. And as you ultimately did, you put the towers, the ladders in four corners. And I'll never forget watching the water just gushing out of the lower floors as it's still smoldering and then burns up top. So that leads us to the call. Henry from Avondale, he's got a question about firefighter safety, which we've just seen. So good morning, Henry. You are on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. And thank you, Chief, for your service. In all of my interactions with the department, your men and women have been just really first class, and the esprit de corps has been great to see. So thank you all. My question is about the health and welfare of those men and women. So I'm just curious about, I'm sure you've looked at studies about cancer rates or COPD rates of firemen, firewomen, and how you take care of your people. And for example, the fire suppression clothing they wear, the heavy coats and pants and the chemicals that are in them. I know you're exposed when you're fighting a fire, you're exposed to all kinds of chemicals, but what about the actual equipment they use or the clothing they wear, and how do you monitor the health of your people long term? That's my question and concern.
Thank you, Henry. Well, what about that? Because we have unfortunately seen some firefighter deaths of late that are not on the scene but are after a call.
So my number one job, the number one thing I do, is make sure our men and women go home safe every day. And that's a tough job when you work in the unknown situations that these men and women work on. I say it all the time. We've got the greatest fire and rescue department in the country, and it's because of the men and women we have serving on the street every day that go above and beyond just what the average, you know, firefighters do out there. But we also are blessed to have a mayor that that supports public safety. It's one of her top priorities. And she makes sure that we have the top of the line, we call it PPE, personal protective equipment. Our bunker gear, our coats and our pants and our helmets that we wear is top of the line. It's the best in the industry. We have departments from all over the country, big, big departments all over the country that want the quote, quote, Jacksonville spec for our bunker gear, because we have, with Lion Apparel, who provides us with our equipment, we have a reputation of having the best in the business. And that's because we have a mayor that cares about firefighter safety and makes sure that, that our folks can go home. But, you know, the caller is right. Firefighters have a 14% greater chance of having cancer than the average citizen out there. And so one of the things that we have to do is make sure that we're doing everything we can in the equipment we provide them and the training we provide them to make sure that they can go home safe and enjoy their retirement. But it's not just the cancer that our folks are dealing with. It's, you know, they're also dealing with the psychological effects of the scenes that they go to as well. And making sure that we're providing that care for them is one of our top priorities. We have the largest peer support team in the state of Florida. We get called by the International Association of Firefighters and other departments to come in and help their departments because our peer support team is so large. And then on top of that, if it's something that the peer support team can't help that firefighter with, then we have different professional groups that we can refer those firefighters to make sure that they're getting the mental health care that they need.
I still, as a hard news reporter, still have very serious dark thoughts about two scenes I was at where I did find, and in one case by surprise, a victim. Because then this is back in the 80s when reporters with care were allowed a little closer. Now, and I don't want to see this, but I understand that. Now, let's go on to something a little more in the crystal ball. What's your dream project? What would you love to see get done, or projects get done while you're chief, get started while you're chief, or maybe as you plan retirement? What would you like to see get done in the next few years?
Continue to provide the fire rescue services that this community needs. That's the number one thing, you know, that we do as a department, is making sure that we have adequate fire and rescue services. And that requires a lot of planning. And there's a lot of folks involved in that planning, the planning phase of that, to help us get to where we want to get. But one of my special projects is the critical care paramedic rescue units. I would love to see in a very short time period, those all become the normal in Jacksonville. And again, we set the standard for the world to look at. That's one of the projects I'm really proud of.
Now, the other thing we were talking about before the show is I've been here for 40 years as a journalist. I don't really remember as much media coverage of the firefighter and police contracts as we've had, whether there was just ability for journalists to come in and watch some of the discussions, get photos, the handshakes, whatever. Characterize this last union contract discussion. Good, bad, tough, easier, what?
I think they're all tough, you know, because the union's looking for a certain level, and then the city has a responsibility, you know, to keep things physically responsible. And so there's a balance there to make sure that our men and women are taken care of, but to also make sure that the tax dollars are spent wisely. One of the things that I do is try to make sure that I treat tax dollars just like I do my own. And anybody that knows me knows I'm extremely tight. I don't spend money. That's just not me. And I try to do the same thing and look after tax dollars the same way. But this negotiation was not a lot different than any of the rest of them. But for some reason, it got a lot of fanfare. A lot of attention was put on. One of the reasons was I think it was a priority of Mayor Deegan to get a good, fair contract to the men and women that serve out there every day. And I think she was proud of that when that was finally accomplished.
Question I've been meaning to ask you: when you were reannounced or as your continuation as fire chief during the news conference at City Hall, I just got the feeling that you weren't going to per se last as long as the Deegan's first term administration. What are your plans? Can you tell me what you're going to do? You know, you're going to hang up the badge at some point soon?
I am. I only have 2 years left. And then I have to retire because of the drop plan. And my plan is to buy a farm and start not commercially farming. I don't want to farm for a living. I just want to farm for fun. And so I look every day. We were, Captain Prosper and myself were just laughing about it a while ago. I look every night at farms that are for sale in South Georgia and North Florida, trying to find one that I can that I can buy and have that set for retirement.
So you are bucking the trend. Former chief administrators usually find teaching jobs or they go to another department nearby. One of your former JFRD video people is now chief of Clay County, has been for years. Certainly many of JSO's people have gone on to become chiefs or sheriffs. So you don't want to instill your knowledge to others?
I want to, my dream has been my whole life is to have this farm. I really want to do that. I think that my granddaddy's farm kept me out of a lot of trouble as a young child. And I want to do the same thing for my grandchildren and give them something, you know, somewhere to go, something to do besides roaming the streets. That's kind of my plan, and that's what I plan to stick to.
And you sort of said before, you want to go out as the chief of a top department. Maybe it just wouldn't be as much fun being in a smaller community.
It's nothing. I came from small Nassau County. I came from there, and great department, but I say this all the time. I've been very fortunate to have gotten to play in the major leagues, and that's where I want to retire from.
One last caller for you, Chief. We have Eric from Arlington who's got an interesting question about, which we had when the Rise Dora went. So, Eric, hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, real quick. I mean this respectfully. How much does it cost to fight a fire, and why is it that we are still fighting fires in the same way that we did 150 years ago? I guess there's just no better way. Would it be helpful if there were cameras in various places so you could look at fires in real time on the way there and decide, you know, how to cost effectively deal with those fires, or are any of these questions relevant? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Eric. And our question back then was, why are we still doing wood frame for multi-story buildings?
You would have to ask the engineers that. That's above a fire chief's pay grade. But what I will say is, water on fire works. That's just how you put them out, right? You cool down the BTUs, and once you get the BTUs to a certain level, it quits burning. You know, it's the triangle. You cut off one side of that triangle, you know, whether it's oxygen, heat, or fuel. When you cut one of those out, the fire goes out. And so that's why we fight fire the way we do. But we do not fight fire the same way we did 100 years ago. The technology that we use is so far more far advanced. To his question about cameras, there are cameras all over. We have a drone team that puts drones up over the top of these fires where we can see them. We have a new tablet command program that allows us to get overhead shots and manage where our firefighters are at, understanding that we need to keep them safe, and knowing it gives the incident commander an opportunity to pull them out of that building when they need to, but it gives him the technology to use to do that, where they used to keep that on a pad and a piece of paper. The technology is gone through the roof, as it done in a lot of industries.
Yeah, those of us at Rise Dora noticed the drones were up, and the drones were giving you real-time information. You could see the smoke and where the flames were coming from. And again, that's where those messages said, hey, we got problems, get out, came from.
Well, the other thing it gives us the ability to do is put those drones in places that we don't have to put a human being in. Where years ago we had to put a human being in there to see that, but now we can put the drone in that place and not have to endanger a firefighter life by doing that. So the technology has really enhanced our ability to send our men and women home safe every day.
All right. We have been talking to Chief Keith Powers, Jacksonville Fire and Rescue Department, the man on the scene. And that's the joke for all these decades I've been covering stuff, is the fire chief, they'd have to usually fight to keep the fire chief from putting on a bunker, a coat, and a mask to go in. So we know you've been in there. Any last just thought for the 15 seconds?
Yeah, just want to thank our men and women for what they do every day. Like I said, we are just blessed as a city to have the folks that we do working for JFRD. They really go above and beyond, and I couldn't be prouder of being able to represent them.
All right. Well, I thank you very much, Keith. Get the dentures in place. Keith Powers, JFRD chief, and quiet guy in the corner is Eric Prosmer, his PIO, and the guy that very nice to deal with. So both of you, thank you. Thanks for so much for being here. Up next, the January 1963 issue of Town & Country magazine called it the perfect house for a bachelor, but a murder would mar its picture-perfect image. Historian, educator, and blogger Tim Gilmore sat down with First Coast Connect host Ann Schindler to share the story of the Bobby Jacobs house.
Welcome back. In 1974, the oceanfront bachelor pad belonging to Jacksonville's construction king became the springboard for a bloodbath. It's one of hundreds of installments of the Jack Psycho Geo blog, and I'm joined now by author, educator, and historian Tim Gilmore, who created the blog. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Ann. How's it going?
Good. It's good to have you here. So this is a house that's still standing in Atlantic Beach.
Yeah.
Created by one of Jacksonville's most renowned and famous architects. Tell us about it.
That's right. Yeah. It's one of Taylor Hardwick's houses. And Taylor Hardwick is best known probably for what's now the Jesse Baldwin Pont Center downtown. Did a number of great, you know, what are now called mid-century modern residences. This house is heavily based on glass and overhanging eaves and focusing on horizontal lines. And the swimming pool itself is actually kind of an integral part of the overall geometry of the house.
And that's because this was a party house.
Yes, that's right. It was a party house. And when it was built, early 1960s, this was called Seminole Beach, which was later become the northern part of Atlantic Beach from about 17th Street North. And back then, it was secluded. It was wild. It was very private. It was a party house for Bobby Jacobs, whose pool parties were absolutely famous, you know, not just here, but in fact, up and down the East Coast.
Wow. Dude was a bit of a playboy.
He was. Yeah, he absolutely was. He was responsible for the construction of lots of the best known buildings in Jacksonville at the time. Some of those are gone now. Thunderbird Motor Hotel and Roosevelt Mall, also the older Independent Life Building, the Universal Marion Building, and he built malls and other enterprises all up and down the East Coast.
And this home wasn't the site of a crime, but it kind of led to a crime. What happened to Bobby Jacobs?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's still a lot of mystery surrounding this. And what happened is it's still, yeah, it's pretty strange. And it has lots of questions unanswered, probably unanswerable now. He had dinner down the street with a friend. And when he came out about 10:30 at night, he had a flat tire. And there's someone who had been staying with that friend off and on, kind of shadowy sort of character, unclear why what his relationship was to any of these people, who offered to fix the tire if Bobby Jacobs would give him a ride down to the exit ramp at Seminole Beach, which was close to Jacobs' house. So Jacobs said okay, and when they got down to that point, this person, whose name was Raymond Beauchesne, took Jacobs into his house, handcuffed him, into Jacobs' own house.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Handcuffed him, shot and killed his dog, and demanded the, in context, kind of paltry sum of $25,000, and said he would kill Jacobs if Jacobs didn't give him $25,000. Jacobs was, you know, uber wealthy. It's kind of a strange situation already.
Yeah.
Jacob said he had some money there, but he had more money at one of his other apartments on the other side of town, the London Town Apartments on Lane Avenue. So they went over there, and when they got there, Jacobs ran out of the car, went up to a couple of guards, said he had been kidnapped. Beauchesne, the kidnapper, stepped out of the car, went into the guard shack. He shot an armed guard, shot Jacobs. And then he shot himself in the throat. Took Jacobs 2 years to die from those wounds. His heart was damaged, and it actually impinged on arguing the case against the person he had dinner with earlier in the night for setting up this extortion.
He was accused of setting it up?
He was, yeah. His name was George Jefferson Willard. He eventually really got away with it because Jacobs was never able to testify. An attorney said that if he couldn't testify, they couldn't, you know, the case depended on him. Willard went on to live a pretty good life. He was president of the Florida Restaurant Association, had his recipes published in Bon Appetit, and died, I think he died in 2010.
I love all the weird wormholes that you
always
explore. So was there some connection to the homicide investigator, perhaps that he'd been involved in a cover-up of another crime?
So many more wormholes attached to that. 10 years before this, so the murder, the shooting happened in 1974, and Bobby Jacobs died in 1976. 10 years before the shooting, a banker's son named Glenn Monroe, really prominent family, had been found shot dead at a dune on Seminole Beach, right now where the walkway, somewhere around where the walkway from 17th Street north onto the beach is. That case looked like it initially had tons of leads, that the investigation was making fast ground, but the investigation was in the hands of Duval County's chief homicide investigator, a guy named J.C. Patrick, who was famous for doing things like breaking the ribs of the people he was interviewing and taking payoffs. The case was the murder was never solved. And 1982, so this is a number of years after all of these people, actually including J.C. Patrick, who was actually killed by his son when his son came home and found Patrick beating his mother one night. All of these people are now dead. 1982, there are three former homicide investigators who claimed that in the mid-60s, they had been fired for trying to expose corruption in the sheriff's office. And 1982, their stories came to light. One of those stories was that Patrick took a payoff to cover up Bobby Jacobs's involvement. Unclear what that involvement was, if it even was true, in Glenn Monroe's murder in 1964. So,
God, it all comes full circle.
It's everything. It's all these stories connect up underground. It's crazy. It really is. But you know, they're also full of holes. And there's a lot of things you can speculate, and you can use logic and evidence to speculate, but you can't necessarily know the truth 100% a lot of times here.
Well, Tim Gilmore, without you, we would never even know half of all of these stories. And it's always a pleasure to explore your blog, Jack Psycho Geo.
Yep.
And thanks once again for joining us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And we'll be right back.
So there's longing in the shoulders now. There was a wildness in that time. Can we now say the sweet were the hours, but ours to find? There was no way to live in simple dreams. There was no straightness to our line. Gravel in hand, the darling we're moving mountains around. This is the fire of leaving pains. When the love is gone, but the need remains. Into the shivering cold of day. When the house is gone, but the street remains. Oh, I guess it's true. I guess these rivers never. So finally the nighttime comes. There is no lie to cast the blame. No need to hide. No fear.
Life South Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with Life South helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
High Tide Burrito and Grace Note Brewery present a Cinco de Mayo Fest, featuring handcrafted Mexican food, a German-style beer specially brewed for Cinco, and music, 11 to 9 this Sunday in the Boatyard on Lakeside Drive in Ortega.
On the next Fresh Air, Taffy Broderser Ackner, author of the novel Fleischman Is in Trouble, which she adapted into a Hulu series. She'll talk about her new novel, Long Island Compromise, which is about the kidnapping of a rich businessman and its impact on his children, who discover their wealth will only go so far to save them. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Thank you. If ever there was a time when you didn't want to have a public health crisis, was at a time of profound divisiveness within our country. That is the worst possible circumstance.
And yet, that's exactly what happened with the COVID pandemic. Dr. Anthony Fauci joins us with lessons learned from that experience and his long career in public health. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Jen White.
And I'm Todd Zwillick.
All elections matter, and the stakes this year are very high.
And that's going to be our focus every Monday.
We're leaving the horse race, the polls, to others. Instead, our focus will be on the stakes for you, for the country, and for our democracy.
Join us every week for our series, If You Can Keep It.
That's next time on 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we are back. She's the founder of not one, but two nonprofits dedicated to helping to build our next generation of women leaders. So where does she find the time and the inspiration? I am joined now by Alyssa Pollard Seymour, a rising nonprofit leader, professional speaker, consultant, and certified etiquette and life coach. Alyssa, that's quite a long list of things. Tell us more about yourself. I mean, what brings you here and what are those programs?
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm born and raised here in Jacksonville, Florida, and I saw a need of with women and girls. My professional career is social work since 1989. I graduated from the University of Florida, and so that brought me back home, and I started my professional career at Daniel, which is the oldest child care serving agency in the state of Florida.
It's probably where we met over the years. I've certainly done many stories there,
I'm sure. And so while I was there, I found a need of young girls. They were coming into a lot. I was managing a homeless mother program. And I thought, hey, let's do something that was more preventative than, you know, resulting from people actually going to jail, well, our young girls going to jail. And so Diva Styles came from me graduating from Florida, but I didn't have the privilege of pledging a sorority because back then things were really different. So when I came home, I had a four-day 40th birthday party that was over the top. Everybody that knows me knows I'm really extra. And so that just continued for the last 17 years. And so in 2014, after my sister Brenda passed, I had the opportunity to start the sisterhood for women who didn't necessarily have a sister and maybe who did not have a collegiate career where they could pledge for in a sorority. And so just life brought all of these opportunities to me. And lastly, Princess and Company, like I said, is our nonprofit. They are 9 years old this month, and Diva Styles is 10 years old this month. And so
how old?
10. We were celebrating our 10-year anniversary, Diva Styles Girlfriend.
If you've made it 10 years, you've obviously done something right, and I guess the numbers are showing success. These are young women who have added education, social education, etiquette. They feel like, you say sisterhood. I didn't pledge to a fraternity in my days. Mm-hmm. I had other things to do, though. I was involved in clubs. You get to learn the socialization, life skills, and you learn some stuff for business, for your work career.
Correct. Absolutely. And with all this being said, this isn't what pays the bills. I actually have a home health care company with my husband, and we provide services to developmental disabled individuals. And we've been in business with that for 20 years in April of this month. So my life is about service. It really is.
Your life is packed full, and that's probably what got you that 12 Who Cares.
Absolutely.
Because they don't pick, minimally interesting people. They've always chosen people, many of whom, if you're a lifelong journalist here, you know that these people know what they do. So what's your typical day like? I mean, when you finish that home health care, you're working after school, I guess?
Absolutely.
So where are you doing this, and what's the age range, and what are you trying to tell these young women?
So Diva Styles is for women 21 and older, and Princess and Company is for kindergarten through 12th grade. And my day typically starts around 7 a.m. in the morning. Of course, I have to have some downtime and maybe a cup of hot tea. And then after that, it's off to the races. Whoever, I'm constantly in the field with the clients. And then my spare time. I manage the other two organizations. I must say, I have the most wonderful team that supports me in both of those organizations. So I'm not able to do all of that by myself. No way.
So how do you get to be part of either of these organizations to work with the younger ladies or the
older ladies,
post-college age women? And what do, how do you vet them? How do you get, make sure you get the cream of the crop?
So there is absolute, there's a process for Diva Styles where you do have to go to our website, divastyles.me, and you can apply there. You'll get more information about what's required. You will be able to come to a meet and greet where we'll give you more specific information. As far as Princess and Company is concerned, it's pretty much the same way, but there's no real, we don't really say no to the girls. Kindergarten through 12th grade, they come in. We meet every third Saturday of the month. We provide enrichment activities. We've taken some to the Biltmore, as I've stated on my 12 Who Cares. We provide etiquette classes. We also host a ball every 2 years, and that is usually where we get funding from. We've also been blessed to be sponsored by Enterprise, Target, and Home Depot.
Wonderful. And you've also got a holiday social here at WJCT Soundstage in December, and tickets are $35. Again, how do people contact or get involved?
Reach out to divastyles.me. That's going to be the easiest way. And my direct number is 904-347-9621.
I thank you very much, Alyssa. Alyssa Pollard-Seymour, two nonprofits that she handles, helping young ladies get an edge as they grow up. And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. If you missed anything, lots of chances here. You can catch our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. or find our entire archive at WJCT.org or on your favorite podcast platform. I can't do this without the people behind the glass. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. The show is produced by Stacey Bennett, directed by Brady Corum. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. Our theme music performed by Club de Belugas. Join us tomorrow when, I'm looking forward to this, Mayor Donna Deegan takes your calls and questions in our monthly Ask the Mayor segment. I'm Dan Scanlon, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.